From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, how safe are California's winter sport resorts? We'll talk with a snow safety expert who helped compile a statewide report that came out today. Also, one of the key parts of the federal health care overhaul is the creation of health benefit exchanges. They're supposed to make health insurance more affordable, but not till 2014. You'll hear how California's exchange is moving along. But first, we continue Brown's Countdown, our series on Governor Jerry Brown's efforts to get a budget deal in 2 months. A little later, you'll hear reaction to Brown's plan to shift more services to the local level. City and county officials generally welcome that idea, but only if enough guaranteed money comes with the extra responsibility. We start, though, with California's court system. Governor Brown is proposing a $200 million cut. What impact would that have, and how are judges responding? Joining us is reporter Emily Green, who writes for the legal newspaper, The Daily Journal. She covers the California court system budget. Emily Green, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much. A pleasure to be here.
Well, $200 million sounds like a lot of money out of a key system, the court system. How does Governor Brown propose to cut all that money without impeding the courts from doing what they do?
Well, interestingly, unlike other branches of government or other agencies, he doesn't have a set plan for how to cut that money. Basically, he's telling the judiciary, I want you to cut $200 million. I'm not going to tell you how. I just want it done.
Why is he not telling them how to do it? He doesn't hesitate, nor does any governor, to tell other agencies to do what to do.
Historically, basically, the practice has been to tell the judiciary, this is your budget. Do with this money what you want. And either you have more money or you have less money or you have the same amount of money. But it's not historically, this is how you spend your money. And they don't give that directive. So this is sort of a continuation of a practice that has been in place for many, many years.
And is that because the judiciary is a branch of government, a separate branch of government from the executive?
I do think that is a big part of it. And this is a point that I wanted to make, is that the judiciary isn't just another agency. So it's not, and not to say that the Department of Education is critically and crucially important, as well as several healthcare programs, et cetera. But the judiciary is the third branch of government. And I do think this is part of the reason why the governor doesn't say, this is what you have to do with the money.
Is $200 million a big percentage of the budget?
It is a big percentage of the budget in the sense that the judiciary at this point is already operating on life support. So any further cuts to the judiciary, and it's already experienced cuts in the past, is really a big blow to them. So they don't have $200 million to lose.
What do you mean the judiciary system is already operating on life support?
Well, basically, they've seen their budget cut in previous years. And this is compounded. The numbers are a little bit, you can talk in and out of the numbers, and they don't always mean so much. But basically, they've seen their budget cut. They need, they say, more money to operate. And what this means is that the trial courts around the state have been laying off hundreds and hundreds of workers. Some courts have literally closed, and others are basically operating at reduced hours. So the judiciary doesn't really have, it's already cut the low-hanging fruit. It's cut the fruit above that, and now it has to really figure out where it's going to make these huge cuts.
We're talking about Governor Brown's proposed $200 million cut to California's court system. My guest is Emily Green, a reporter with the legal newspaper, The Daily Journal. She's been writing about this issue for several months, not just the proposed budget cut now, but previous budget cuts. Mm-hmm. Emily, you've spoken with many people who work in the system, including someone in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm. That's right, I have. And this is what it's the presiding judge of the Los Angeles County Superior Court. The Los Angeles County Superior Court is the biggest court system in the country. So not just in California, but the country. It's huge. And this is what the presiding judge, Lee Edman, had to say about the proposed $200 million cuts.
Essentially, they are very, very deep cuts on top of deep cuts that we've already had to take. What that's going to mean and the impact that it's going to have on this court is I can't tell you yet, because we're just in the process of trying to assimilate the information and look at our budget and our bottom line. But unfortunately, every option is going to have to be back on the table.
And so when they talk about every when Lee Edmund talks about every option back on the table, basically in parts of 2000, for about 10 months between 2009 and 2010, the courts had to initiate a deeply, deeply unpopular once a month the courts were closure, or excuse me, once a month the courts were closed. So this is something that every member of the judiciary wants to avoid. It's not clear that they are going to avoid it. And going back to the Los Angeles County Superior Court, when she says this is on top of deep cuts that we've already had to make, last year, the Los Angeles County Superior Court lost 500 employees. So it's not like they haven't done anything. They lost 500 employees. I think 350 of those employees were through layoffs, and another 150 around there was through actually employees leaving, and they never replaced those jobs. So it's sort of like you've already lost 500 people. What are you going to do now? Perhaps court closures is the only option.
What about California's top judge, the new Chief Justice Tani Cantil Sakaue? Has she spoken in public about this?
She did. I spoke to her the day the proposal came out, and what she told me is, and this is a quote, "It's deep, it's grave, and it's alarming to us." And again, she noted that the reduction is on top of reductions in the past, and that basically she said, "I'm going to fight this. I don't think it's fair. We've already experienced our..." I don't know if she said, "I don't think it's fair," but she said, "I'm going to fight it."
Okay. Now, no one likes having their budget cut, but all budgets are being cut, as far as I can tell, in California, and have been for some time. What does the governor say?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And I think even members of the judiciary recognize that. And it's sometimes hard. They want to say, it's like Tani Cantil Sakaue, it's deep, it's grave, and it's alarming. And yet she also, in the same breath, recognizes that other departments have had serious, serious budget cuts, specifically education and healthcare programs. I think the governor is sort of in no mood to entertain anybody. He wants everybody to cut back. He, I think, cut his department by 25%. And what he said in his budget proposal regarding the judiciary is basically the judiciary has had financial problems for a long time. And what they've done consistently are one-time solutions. So they'll kind of shift money around within its budget. They'll move money that was allocated for one project and put it to the trial courts. And he said, listen, you can't just rely on one-time solutions year in and year out. You actually have to find some long-term solutions for how you're going to fix, how are you going to reduce your budget.
We're talking about judicial cuts in California. Emily Green is a reporter with the legal newspaper, The Daily Journal. You said that the governor is not dictating how the judiciary should make the cuts. He's just saying, this is how much money I plan to give you. Do you have any idea yet of how the judiciary would make the cuts, assuming they happen?
Well, I've talked to several members of the judiciary. They've been quite cagey about it, to be quite frank. And I think maybe for good reason. They don't want to say, hey, we're going to close courts one day a month if they don't know that they actually have to do that. I think it's a little difficult because, of course, this is the governor's proposal. So it's not exactly clear that they're going to have $200 million cut. There was one line in the governor's proposal that said there is a possibility that the judiciary would get some money that we would have left over from the closure of the redevelopment funds, of the redevelopment agencies. So this could interestingly pit the redevelopment agencies against the judiciary. It didn't say in the governor's proposal where this option came from, who was proposing it. There's just literally one line. And also you have to note that last year, the Governor Schwarzenegger proposed cutting $100 million from the judiciary's budget, which he later reinstated. So just to be clear, it's not certain that they're going to have $200 million cut. With that said, they're going to have something cut, most likely. And I think everybody thinks it means more layoffs, more furloughs, shorter hours at the court. If you need to pay your traffic ticket, that might take you 4 hours instead of 45 minutes.
And delays in trials, no doubt.
And delays in trials, most definitely. And delays in decisions are reducing clerks' hours.
Governor Brown has talked a lot about realignment, his plan to shift more of the responsibilities of the state to the local level. Does he see realignment in the judicial system too?
Absolutely. And this is really where the criminal aspect of the judicial system comes in. So he wants to move low-level offenders, parole violators, and all juvenile offenders to the control of the counties. I just read an interesting article actually this morning in the Sacramento Bee that said counties aren't so hot on that idea because the county's jails are already overcrowded. So they're not so excited about the prospect of getting more potential offenders that is in their control. So he's really talking about realigning a large portion of the criminal aspect of the judiciary to counties.
And court security is an issue, too. The cost of court security has risen a lot.
Yes, this is a huge, huge problem for the judiciary is court security. I read a legislative analyst office report that basically said court security has increased annually 8%. Every year it's increasing 8%. This is a big deal for a judiciary which is trying to cut its budget. And part of the problem is, in some ways, sheriffs provide court security for the judiciary. And in some in kind of an odd way, they have a monopoly on it. Basically, according to the law, the sheriffs have to provide security for the courts. And what the legislative analysts say is that this means they have a monopoly. They have no incentive to reduce their cost. And the judiciary is kind of in a tough spot where it can't dictate. So,
and right now, the state compensates the sheriffs for that security, correct?
The state compensates. I'm not quite sure the mechanism by which it works, but I think the state gives the judiciary money, which then in turn cuts a deal with the sheriffs. So I think really one of the big, big problems and challenges for the judiciary is going to be to figure out how to reduce these costs, because it's overburdening them, especially when you're talking about trying to cuts key and essential services for the courts.
Emily Green, reporter with the legal newspaper The Daily Journal. She's been writing for several months about the California court system budget, including Governor Brown's proposed $200 million cut. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, more on California's budget problems as we continue our series Brown's Countdown. When we come back, reaction to Governor Brown's plan to shift more services from the state to local government. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Our webpage is capradio.org/insight. You'll find lots of things there, photographs, links, and so on. You can also follow our show on Facebook, and you can follow me on Twitter. Links again at capradio.org/insight. This morning in Talk of the Nation, a look at triage, the emergency medical procedures you find on battlefields and recently in a Tucson shopping center. Also, the curious tale of an elite Israeli assassination squad in Dubai, and actor Ed Harris takes listener calls. We continue Brown's Countdown, our series on Governor Jerry Brown's efforts to get a budget deal in 2 months. Earlier today, we talked about Brown's proposed cut to California's judicial budget. Part of that cut could involve transferring more responsibility to the counties, part of a wider plan by the governor to devolve power away from Sacramento, and that's called realignment. Many local officials welcome that shift, but have concerns about whether they'd have enough money to pay for all this. Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler sat down with Sacramento County's top executive, Steve Zaley, to get his reaction.
What do you think of the governor's realignment proposals?
Well, I believe that crisis breeds opportunity, and I'm a big believer of that. And I think at the outset, the suggestions that he's put forth have merit. The counties are geared up, especially Sacramento County, we're geared up to have some real good discussions on how we put together this program so it could be successful. And the areas that he's looking at, child welfare services, foster care, low-level offenders from the state to county jails, parole, probation, consolidation, juvenile justice responsibilities, court security, and public safety programs that are currently funded by a piece of the vehicle license fee. I think the concepts are quite good. What we are very concerned with is that we will have the proper flexibility, that there's money tied to it, and that there be a mechanism for the future beyond the 5 years, because his proposal is to fund this with the increased revenues that were done a few years ago, continuing those for 5 years. And so we would want constitutional protection. So overall, I'm enthused, and my colleagues around the state, especially in the 12 urban counties, are ready to roll up our sleeves and see what we come up with.
Well, why would this be successful for Sacramento County?
The services that he's talking about in many cases can be more efficiently provided at the local level with less state oversight and more flexibility. A good example is the movement of low-level state offenders to county jails. It's not as though the counties have a lot of extra room in the jails, but the fact of the matter is if low-level offenders do their sentences at the local level, there's a better chance of successful reentry into the community. Money would come along with the inmates, and some of that money could be used for programs to help with the reentry process.
Well, you mentioned that the Sacramento County jails are overcrowded, and I guess I'm having trouble seeing how you would be able to absorb all of the extra inmates. You could get money, but I guess you'd have to take that money and build more jail cells, right? Because you've already had to release some prisoners over the last year.
There would have to either be additional capacity, or there could be other ways to deal with prisoners. One of the things that many counties have tried unsuccessfully to get is approval for GPS ankle bracelets so that low-level inmates could actually be released from the institutions but still have control over them in a more of a probation arrangement. That would be much less expensive than housing the prisoners and would make room for other prisoners that had revenue assigned to them, and then you could develop those reentry programs. It would be helpful.
When it comes to social services, the money that the counties get from the states, if it's just used to backfill cuts that have been made from county services, and you're also required to provide services to more people or provide more services, wouldn't counties still find themselves in an unsustainable financial position?
If that's the case, once we conclude these discussions with the governor's office, then we probably wouldn't be supportive. So we're just starting. We're just in the starting blocks on this. And so I agree with you. It needs to make sense from a programmatic standpoint, needs to have money attached to it, needs to be constitutional and allow for growth in the future.
We have a new Sacramento County grand jury report out that talks about how decimated the county probation department is, and yet the governor's realignment also includes shifting parole responsibilities to the county. So how could Sacramento County absorb that?
Once again, with funding, though, shifting that with funding, you have to keep that in mind. Right now, the county has probation responsibilities, adult and juvenile, and the state has parole responsibilities for adults. The concept is, could those be provided on a more efficient basis if there was a consolidation of those services? And again, that bears discussion. That's an interesting concept. And if it came with money, it could be that the level of service at the county level could be increased.
How about a little history lesson in that you were the top administrator at Alameda County during the last round of realignment in 1991, and what do you feel the impact has been since then?
The flow of funding for those programs has worked very well. There's formula allocations. It's essentially sales tax and vehicle license fees. And right now, those revenues are down overall, so there's had to be cuts. It's actually worked quite well. There has been more flexibility. County plans are developed on an annual basis. And I think overall, it's worked. One of the advantages back in 91 is that we had over a year to develop that program and fine-tune it. In this case, we're on a much faster track.
Anything else in the governor's budget proposal that you're keeping an eye on? So, for example, the potential elimination of redevelopment agencies, which could affect future Sacramento County projects?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. We're very unique in the state of California. We have a joint redevelopment agency between the city of Sacramento and the county of Sacramento, which has really run quite efficiently over the years. If the program has changed, we have some principles that we want to see followed. Number one, the existing projects need to continue where there's funding and bonding that has been secured. That needs to be continued.
And that's in the governor's proposal, I think.
And that's in the governor's proposal. And property taxes. What this is an investment of property taxes in economic development for the most part. That's what redevelopment is. Depending on how the program might be changed in the future, we would want to make sure that the county is intimately involved in the allocation of monies. So we're gonna watch it very carefully, but we want to make sure that nothing gets in the way of a successful business model, which is one that we have at the current time.
We're talking with Stephen Zaley, the interim Sacramento County executive, about Governor Brown's budget proposal and some of the proposed realignments of state services to local governments, and also wanted to bring in this grand jury report that's just out that basically criticizes the budget cuts and says public safety has been eroded and that the safety net is in tatters. And at the same time, of course, it says to you, Stephen Zaley, we think you've been doing a reasonably good job under the circumstances. It's still not a particularly fun grand jury report, though, right?
No, and I would, I'd certainly agree with the last part. I spent quite a bit of time with the grand jury, and others have too, on the budget cuts that we've had to make at the county level in order to get us to the point where current revenues pay for current services. And all across the county departments have taken very heavy cuts over the past 2 years. But we have sized our organization to the revenue we receive. And so we're at the point now in moving into this fiscal year where our budget gap will be in the neighborhood of $40 to $60 million, which is a far cry from the over $180 million that we had to deal with last year. And I will be the first to admit the cuts were onerous, but I think they were done in a thoughtful way, and I think the service levels were maintained to the absolute best that we could with the money available. I think the grand jury is just this year, this is every year, it's a new grand jury, and I think they're pretty shocked at what occurred, but this is not just happening in Sacramento County or in the cities in Sacramento County, it's happening all over the state of California as elected bodies deal with the lowered revenue and the increased costs.
Well, and finally, you referenced this a moment ago in terms of the budget. We can't talk to the top executive at a county these days without asking the budget shape, and you're not making any mid-year budget cuts. The deficit for the coming fiscal year that starts in July, $40 to $50 million, and yet you've already cut so much. Where in the world can you find another $40 or $50 million to cut?
What you're talking about is doing business differently. One of the four parts of our fiscal turnaround in Sacramento County is what we're calling new efficiencies, new and better ways of doing business that save money, increase revenue, and increase service value. And I'll give you a couple of examples. The county provides full animal care services. The city of Sacramento does the same. The SPCA provides shelter services, and various cities also provide animal care services. We've been working for the past several months on how we could save money and actually improve services by combining our operations. Second one is 911 emergency dispatch services. There are 55 of these new efficiencies that we're looking at. So that will help us meet the budget gap, but we'll still have further service reductions. Now, you do need to know that the $60 million is against the $2 billion general fund budget, you know, essentially a 3% reduction. And so it will be difficult. One of the things we're trying to do is, in our labor negotiations, is get to the point where we have no labor cost increases for the next 2 years. So there are a lot of strategies going on, but there will be cuts, there will be position reductions, and there could be some layoffs, but certainly not to the extent as in the last 2 years. And we do see that during fiscal year 11-12, our property tax revenue will stabilize and our sales tax revenue will stabilize and perhaps start growing a bit.
Stephen Zaley is Sacramento County's interim executive officer. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, how a key part of the effort to rein in healthcare costs in California is progressing. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. If something you heard in our show is on your mind, you can tell us about it in an email. Our address is insight@capradio.org. Tomorrow, a Nevada County couple whose daughter was killed by a mentally ill man in a mass shooting in January 2001. Also, we continue our series on the plans to build a new arena in Sacramento. We'll talk with developer Jerry Camillus. A key part of the federal health care overhaul is the creation of so-called health benefit exchanges. They're supposed to help make health insurance more affordable for individuals and smaller businesses, but not until 2014. In one of his last actions as governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger appointed two of his top aides to the California Health Benefit Exchange Board, including Kim Balshea, his former Health and Human Services Secretary. I spoke recently with Balshea and asked her, what is a health benefit exchange?
Health Benefit Exchange is a new online marketplace or purchasing option for individuals and employees of small businesses. The idea behind a benefit exchange is to give individuals and small businesses the same kind of purchasing clout and the same kind of choices and the same kind of competition for their business as large businesses are able to provide their employees. The exchange is also the venue through which individuals who are eligible for a federal tax credit can use those tax credits to purchase affordable coverage and meet the requirements of the federal mandate.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people who are uninsured or can barely afford their insurance like the sound of that, but they're probably wondering why it takes so long for this to come into effect, because it's several years, isn't it?
Absolutely. The major provisions of federal health reform take effect on January 1 of 2014. That seems a long way away, particularly for those individuals who are uninsured today or grappling with the rising costs of health care. Our guiding motto for implementation has been 2014 is tomorrow, because given the complexity and the magnitude of the undertaking in terms of standing up this health benefit exchange, which will provide a venue for upwards of 4 or 5 million Californians to purchase insurance, it's going to require quite a bit of time. And that's why Governor Schwarzenegger in the previous legislature felt such urgency that California actually is the first state in the nation to put into statute this health benefit exchange.
So the length of time it will take to fully implement this is because of the complexity.
Absolutely. California, like all states that decide to implement a health benefit exchange, will need to have eligibility and enrollment systems that are in place that can accommodate millions of people coming forward. There'll need to be broad outreach, education, and social marketing efforts to inform people about their new responsibilities to purchase insurance effective January 1 of 2014, as well as the availability of new federal programs. We're going to have to establish plan participation standards to determine what health plan choices will be made available. So there's a whole series of activities required for standing up, which really is a new commercial enterprise.
Some critics of the federal health insurance overhaul have said that some of the big ticket items have been put off until after the next presidential election so that President Obama doesn't need to deal with big expenses justifying them leading into the election. Is that part of the reason why this important part of the overhaul is put off until 2014?
I would defer to those members of Congress that put up the votes for the bill that had those implementation dates. What I do know from a state implementation perspective is that endeavors of this magnitude, complexity, and consequence do require some time. Again, California is standing up what is effectively a new commercial enterprise that will provide the venue for millions and millions of Californians to purchase insurance. We want to make sure we do it right, and that's going to take a little bit of time.
My guest is Kim Balshea. She was, until very recently, the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state of California, and she has been appointed, was appointed by outgoing Governor Schwarzenegger to California's Health Benefit Exchange Board, which is an important part of the implementation mechanism for the federal health care overhaul. Governor Schwarzenegger tried, before President Obama took office, to lead a health insurance overhaul in California, but it didn't work out. It seems, though, that the federal overhaul is somewhat similar to what Governor Schwarzenegger and his allies in the legislature were planning to do. Why did it not work out in California, whereas it did at the federal level just a year or two later? Mm-hmm.
Well, California, under the governor's leadership and former Speaker Fabian Nunez's leadership back in 2007, did endeavor to put forward a very comprehensive approach to reform that, in some respects, was a model for the reforms that ultimately were enacted in Washington, an approach that's predicated on the goals of near universal coverage, starting with a requirement that insurance plans have to offer coverage regardless of health status, a requirement that individuals exercise personal responsibility and purchase insurance, that government programs be available for the lowest income Californians through an expansion of Medicaid, as well as the creation of this health benefit exchange to provide a new purchasing option for those whose incomes are above Medicaid, but still where affordability is a challenge. And then undergirding all of that are a series of reforms to improve affordability as well as invest in prevention and wellness. So I think, frankly, given California's experience in 2007, it was one of the reasons why we were able to move so quickly as a state in 2010 with implementation, where other states were still trying to understand, well, what is a purchasing pool or a health benefit exchange? California had already gone through those policy discussions. We had weighed issues of governance, approach, and strategy. We had talked about how to maximize the effectiveness of a purchasing pool, and we've built coalitions and support. So California's starting place was very different from other states, and I think that's why we've been able to move forward so aggressively and effectively. Why were we not successful in 2007? There are a whole variety of reasons of why that is so. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think California's experience really has helped support our ability to move forward responsibly.
Well, California is moving quickly on setting up its health benefit exchange, but there are quite a number of other states that are fighting the federal healthcare overhaul, including setting up health benefit exchanges. If a lot of other states don't set up health benefit exchanges, would that undermine what's happening in California?
Well, under federal law, states have a choice. They can choose to administer a health benefit exchange, or if they choose not to, the federal government will do that for that particular state. California policymakers said in the affirmative, we, California, want to control our own fate. We know our marketplace. We can act in the best interest of the people of our state. So California is moving forward with its own health benefit exchange. Frankly, Jeffrey, I'm expecting that even in those states where there's active litigation against federal reform, we will see states step up and decide that they too want to implement an exchange, because those governors, those legislators, even though they may be concerned about federal reform, they know what's in the best interests of their residents. They understand their insurance marketplace. And I think we'll see a two-track strategy where we'll see the litigation going forward on one track, but I think we're going to see more and more governors really stepping up regardless of their perspective and putting the building blocks in place, including the exchanges.
What is the role, if any, of insurance companies in the Health Benefit Exchange Board? Do they play a part in it, or would they be in a business relationship with the board, or even an adversarial one?
Well, most fundamentally, the health benefit exchange is about selling insurance. And so the benefit exchange board, of which I'm one of five members, has been given the authority through the state legislation creating the exchange to establish insurance plan participation standards that will determine what plans are offered as a choice to those individuals and employees of small businesses that purchase insurance through the exchange. Those decisions will be made in a public, transparent process. This is a public agency, and will be informed by input by the plan community, consumers, and others. So we would look, it's a business relationship, but I certainly would expect it to be a collaborative one, because at the end of the day, the exchange's success is going to be dependent upon offering choice that consumers value.
What if you and your colleagues on the board cannot come up with enough health insurance options that are comprehensive enough as plans and affordable enough without premiums rising by a large percentage every year? Mm-hmm. What's the option?
Well, a couple things. Number one, under federal reform, the exchange is the sole venue through which individuals who are eligible for a federal tax credit can purchase insurance. Those are individuals with income, say, a family of three, between about $24,000 a year and $73,000 a year. That's about 2 to 3 million people. That provides a very strong incentive for insurance companies to want to offer their plans through the pool. That's a significant market. So that's observation number one. And then number two, having that kind of purchasing clout in terms of purchasing on behalf of, some estimates suggest the exchange could be purchasing on behalf of upwards of 5 million people, provides an opportunity to really advance more value-based purchasing, to identify plan participation standards that advance goals around quality as well as price and service, and create more competition based upon price, value, quality, as opposed to plans competing by avoiding or segmenting risk.
My guest is Kim Balchet, until very recently Secretary of Health and Human Services at the state of California. and now a member of California's Health Benefit Exchange Board. President Obama's healthcare overhaul was criticized not just from the right, but also by some on the left who thought it didn't go nearly far enough. Where did you fit in on that continuum?
Well, it was actually that very question, that very issue that contributed to California's lack of success back in 2007, 2008. The folks who embrace a vision on either end of the continuum embrace that vision very, very aggressively and firmly. From, on one hand, really a government-run and administered healthcare system for all residents. The other end of the continuum is more of a market-based approach. Governor Schwarzenegger's approach in 2007, and in many respects, the approach ultimately enacted in federal law, rejected, frankly, both ends of that continuum, and rather put forward more of a middle ground approach that recognizes the importance of building upon our market-based system of care, but also doing so in a way that strengthens the regulatory structure that governs it. So, frankly, I think California tried to achieve, and I think federal reform in some respects has, that reasonable and responsible middle ground between those two competing ends of the political continuum. And time will tell the extent to which we, in fact, will be successful in our state. I would note federal reform provides a very broad framework. At the end of the day, it's up to the state. It's up to Governor Brown and his administration, our state legislature, program administrators, and this new exchange board to determine whether or not reform actually means something in practice in a real and meaningful way for the people of California in terms of coverage, affordability, and improvements in the health status of our residents.
There are millions of uninsured and underinsured people in California. If one of them came up to you and said, Kim, I can't afford health insurance and I really need it, how do I know that all of this is going to lead to me being able to afford to buy health insurance?
Well, in the near term, there's some places to go. California has put into place something called a pre-existing condition insurance plan, PCIP. And the pre-existing condition insurance plan provides access to more affordable coverage for people who have not been able to purchase insurance because of an underlying medical condition. This is wholly federally funded as a part of reform. We expect it will serve tens of thousands of Californians. So that is one place someone can go if they've been excluded from insurance because of their underlying health condition. As a second place, potentially, if they're lower income, the Schwarzenegger administration negotiated what's called a waiver with the federal government for our Medicaid program that is enabling the counties to expand coverage to upwards of 500,000 low-income single adults who come 2014 will be eligible for Medicaid coverage. So based upon where someone lives and county participation in that program, there will be some important expansions of coverage for very low-income individuals. I would also encourage that person, if their income is relatively low, to see if there are public programs for which they might be eligible.
Finally, Kim, whenever an administration turns around, there are a lot of appointments of former lawmakers and former staffers to commissions, some of which pay quite generously. This board, the California Health Benefit Exchange Board, does not pay a salary, as I understand. Is this a full-time uncompensated job, or is it a part-time uncompensated job? And if so, what are you doing otherwise? Now you're no longer Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Correct. The Health Benefit Exchange Board is a 5-member board, and there is no compensation beyond travel and those kinds of expenses for serving. I think it is for board members, a labor of love. It is a labor for those of us who care passionately about health reform implementation, who believe that the exchange has a potential to be transformative in terms of expanding coverage and improving affordability and choice. And for those of us who want to continue to make a contribution on behalf of the people of California. So all that and no pay makes for a wonderful reward. And the reward and the compensation, frankly, is to be of service and to contribute along with my other 4 colleagues on the exchange board.
But will you be looking for other jobs in government?
I will be gainfully employed, but it will not be in government. And it will enable me to be of service on the exchange board and be of service, most importantly, certainly to my new employer.
Kim Belshe, formerly Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state of California, now a member of the California Health Benefit Exchange Board. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Inside. Coming up, how safe are California's winter sport resorts? You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. It's been a great winter so far for people who love winter sports, thanks to all that snow up in the mountains. But skiing and snowboarding, not to mention snow itself, can be dangerous, and so we hope that the mountain resorts are fully focused on safety. A new report out today surveys the safety practices at California's winter sport resorts, including all the well-known places near Tahoe. Joining us with the report highlights is Richard Penniman, Chief Research Officer at the Snow Sports Safety Foundation. Richard Penniman, welcome back to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's great to be back on the show.
Now, it's been a few years. You talked about avalanches many years ago on our program.
Yes, indeed.
But we're going to talk more generally about safety. Overall, how focused on safety are California's ski resorts?
They're generally fairly focused on safety aspects, especially with respect to lifts and you know the lodge and so forth. But at the present time, there aren't any laws or regulations governing impact mitigation out on the hills or hazard marking and that sort of thing. So every resort is really kind of on its own to figure that stuff out.
The people, including yourself, who worked on this report, the California Mountain Resort Safety Report, visited all the major mountain resorts in California. What exactly were they looking for?
Well, we focused on two basic aspects of safety out on the hill. We looked at impact mitigation. That would be things like pads and fences and devices that prevent people from contacting lift towers and outbuildings and that sort of thing that may be near or on the trails. And then we looked at trail design and maintenance. So the actual design of the trail itself, there are certain safety aspects that you can address in keeping the trails from being incorrectly built. And if there are hazards like surface hazards or things that people can't see the full extent of, there's ways of marking those hazards and putting up warning signs and that sort of thing. So those were the primary focuses.
How big are the differences between these safety practices at California's winter sport resorts? If you look at the safest and the least safe, how big a spread is there?
There's a big spread. And it's really not necessarily safety with respect to whether accidents are prevented one way or the other. We don't have the statistics on that. But what we looked at specifically was what is being done and to what extent it's being done. And I would say that the consistency of what is being done varies greatly over the spectrum of, I think we had 25 different ski resorts.
My guest is Richard Penniman, Chief Research Officer and member of the Board of Directors of the Snow Sports Safety Foundation. They just released a report on safety at California's winter sport resorts. Is there a way to say which winter resort in California had the best score?
Well, we strictly avoided getting into that issue of good, better, best. What we tried to do in the report was provide an educational resource for people, parents, for school ski club advisors, for ski club trip planners, that kind of thing, to look at the various aspects of resorts where safety is addressed. We looked at about 17 different things that we could measure objectively that weren't weather dependent, that weren't crowd dependent. And these were things that you would expect to see on any given day at any ski resort. Tower pads would be sort of an example of that. Our report was conducted on a weekday. We did it anonymously so that we could get a very objective view of what the resort was doing. And admittedly, it's just a snapshot on one given day. So we tried to list the things that we could observe objectively, and then provide information that people could look at and say, well, these things I care about, these things I don't. It's really an individual thing. So it's not whether the resort is safer or not as safe. It's what are they doing with respect to safety and how consistently.
Still, the California Mountain Resort Safety Report does list the overall average scores for all these resorts. And three of the top four are Tahoe area resorts, well-known ones, North Star, Sierra Tahoe, and Tahoe Donner. Number one, though, the highest overall score was Badger Pass. Where's Badger Pass?
Badger Pass is in Yosemite National Park. It's a very small little resort. It's got a couple of lifts. So there's not much terrain there to have to deal with. And
I see.
And that's why it's really not a measure of which resort is good, better, or best. It's what they've done with what they have.
But what's up with Mount Baldy, which had by far the lowest score?
Well, they just didn't do a lot in terms of skier and snowboarder protection. The obstacles that were on the hill didn't have pads, and they didn't put a lot of fences up and a lot of signs. It was pretty much in a rough state. But if you like that kind of thing, that would be a good resort to go to. So it's really kind of an individual thing on safety.
Yes. Who paid for this? Did the resorts pay for it?
No, we are totally independent from the resorts. The resorts, I don't believe, knew we were doing this. We tried to do sort of a blind study. And we had several foundations that donated, several individuals who donated to the Snow Sports Safety Foundation for conducting this study. So the group that we had doing the actual surveys were paid for their time and expenses, but it was all donations.
Have the resorts had a chance to respond to the report?
We are actually breaking the report out as we speak. We wanted to give NPR the first shot at it here, and the report has been sent to the California Ski Industries Association, and it is going out on our website, which is snowsportssafetyfoundation.org. So it's available right now under the research button when you get to that website.
Is there a common problem that you found across the board or more or less across the board in California's snow resorts?
Well, not a problem so much as a consistency that I don't think many people are aware of. When you go to a resort and you look at lift towers, those are the big tall poles that hold the chairlifts up, you'll see that some of them are on the trails, some of them are very near the trails. And almost every resort, when those are exposed to potential impact from skiers and snowboarders, are padded. But what we found is the pads that are being used are good for collisions of probably less than 5 to 7 miles per hour. And most skiers are going 30 to 40 miles an hour. So they don't do much. They're just fairly cosmetic. But there are other pads and other good fences and devices that some resorts are using.
Do you have a top recommendation to make to California's winter sport resorts?
Not so much the resorts. I think the recommendation is to the people who go to the resorts. I think being forewarned is being forearmed, and the more education you have about what the resorts are doing on their behalf, the better their experience is going to be. I think the resorts realize that having return customers and keeping the customers healthy and happy is just good business. So most of the resorts do quite a bit on behalf of the skiers to make the environment as user-friendly as possible. But I don't think a lot of people who go to the resorts really know what the resorts are doing for them, and the resorts don't advertise that sort of thing. So that's why we wanted to do the studies, to make people aware of what's going on at the resorts on their behalf, and so that they can judge for themselves.
And finally, you live in the Truckee area. You're getting a lot of skiing and or snowboarding done, I guess.
Oh, boy, it's been great. I don't snowboard, but I do ski, and I do a lot of backcountry skiing and also Nordic skiing. And the resort skiing has just been fabulous this year. It's been really good.
Yes. Well, and hopefully it's a safe one for everyone who's participating. Richard Penniman, Chief Research Officer and member of the Board of Directors of the Snow Sports Safety Foundation. They just released today their California Mountain Resort Safety Report that gave the website address. You'll also find the link in our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Jeffrey. Thanks.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Liz Cazares. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. We'll be back tomorrow. Citizens Committee is reviewing proposals for a new arena in Sacramento. On the next Insight, we continue our series on all four plans. Developer Jerry Camillus explains how his new plan is different from the one that collapsed last year. Plus, a Nevada County couple whose daughter was killed by a mentally ill man in a mass shooting in January 2001, the leaders in the Brady campaign to prevent gun violence. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow morning at 10 on Capital Public Radio.